Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. It's so nice to have you here on this December the 30th on the West Coast. If you're in the Eastern or Central time zones of the United States, you are now experiencing the beginning hour of the last day of 2008. Into what is popularly known as New Year's Eve. And we hope you stay with us for the next hour. We have a great show for you tonight. Just wrapping in the nutshell all the things going on in the world into one little package. Let's call it a New Year's Eve package. There's quite a bit of chaos going on around the world, and a lot of fear-mongering. We're going to approach tonight, which has been a recurring theme throughout the past 2 months, a solution-based show. We may talk about some of the things going on, but in the context of how we can change them for something positive, something that we create amongst ourselves, using our own talents, our own skills, our creativity, which is a word I love because of my love for music and my love for writing and original thinking. And tonight's guest is an original thinker. He happens to be an attorney specializing in constitutional issues as well as antitrust law. He's taken on some of the biggest companies on the planet. He is a man of principle, always thinking of we regular folks, and because of, or I should say, us regular folks, in the context of my grammar, he is the founder and owner of a number of websites. Three that really come to mind are his MyClads website, which is a means through which you can market your talents, your skills in the form of tasks. We're going to be talking about that tonight. We're going to be talking a little bit about his website called LawMall. I'm leaving the .coms and all of that off of this right now. And he has a new one called Daily BSD. Most people know what BS stands for. We're not going to use the words, but he even has a sense of humor. And, of course, the D following stands for deal. So the Daily BS Deal, in a sense, is his new website. And it's quite interesting because he actually is talking about many of the things that I and my guests talk about on the show when we tackle some of the political issues that are going on, some of the economic issues, which are what are really driving politics anyway, much to our dismay. And before I go on any further, I would like to introduce again and welcome back to the show a good friend of mine, attorney Carl Pearson. Carl, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Don, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back, and I look forward to the next hour.
So do I. I love the name of your newest site. I think it's just it's telling it like it is. And have you gotten much feedback from those folks that you know already that are aware of this new site?
Well, I haven't even begun to get any marketing for the site. So it's hard to get sites going, and that drives me into suing Google. Google is a way that people could market their sites. They have a tremendous system called AdWords, And AdWords is where somebody is doing a search for some subject. They put in the search terms such as elephant. And if anyone is in the business of selling elephants, they could then put an ad before the people that are doing a search for elephants, and for a nickel or a dime can get a lead for the sale of an item that could cost maybe $10,000. I mean, if you tried to sell an elephant by running advertisements in a newspaper, it would probably take you $50,000 worth of ads. But with this device of or the system called AdWords, a person can get a lead for the sale of an airplane or the sale of a railroad car and get it for maybe 10 cents. So that is phenomenal. And you could develop leads for websites. You should only have to pay a penny to get people into your website. So I started doing that, and then Google changed the deal on me overnight and said, from now on you have to pay 50 cents instead of a penny. So they priced me out of the market, and I'm really angry, so I brought suit.
Well, that doesn't seem fair. It's almost like they're singling you out. I was wondering, just as a side comment here, I wonder if you put waste removal. Do you think an ad for Congress would come up or something?
Well, I tell you, this is just, what is going on is just so criminal. It is just, we have the, they've stolen our country and they continue to steal it. And they do it from under our nose. They give away trillions of dollars under our nose, and they aren't shy about it. They're not embarrassed. They're giving away our livelihood. They're giving away our birthright. It's just outrageous, I'm telling you. Just absolutely outrageous.
Well, that's a topic, as you well know, that I cover on Evident Footprints almost on a nightly basis. And I say that because there are just some nights where we're talking about totally different things. I may even bring up a news item at the beginning of the show or somewhere in the middle because it's something that's on people's minds. But we want to transcend that in a sense tonight and talk about some of the things you're doing. Now, we have more listeners all the time, and for some people this is going to be repetitive in a sense, and yet it's the repetition we require sometimes to have an idea, a thought, a new concept come to the forefront of our consciousness. And so I don't mind revisiting any of these things that we may talk about tonight. We can, you know, you brought up a very good point. As I said, we talk about these issues, and there seems to be a general theme of helplessness about the public, as though they're waiting for someone to make the move that pushes us into a new paradigm of prosperity or abundance, whatever word you want to term, or whatever term you want to use for that idea of wealth. And people are interested in holding on to their wealth. It seems to be able to slip through our fingers. And, of course, you brought up one reason why. And when I first learned about what you were doing, about your work, I became very interested because I saw this is solution-oriented. This puts the power of what one can do in one's own hands where it really belongs. Do you want to comment on that in a general sense before we go into specifics?
Yes, I think the I've been working for years on getting to know how the system works. I'm a lawyer. I went to Harvard Law School. I went to college and did very well there. And I continue to learn how the system operates. And as a result, I figured out ways by which things can be done that other people who aren't lawyers really would only guess. Maybe they would be right about it, maybe not. But they don't have the technical knowledge that I have and other lawyers have so that I can figure out how things can be done. So as a result, I don't go around telling people, gee, I wish that we have a constitutional amendment, or why don't they do something? Why don't they change the law and pass a statute and do something that we want? Instead, I said, look, you and I can't really change any statutes, and even let's forget about constitutional amendments. Is there something that we can do ourselves to cure a problem? And if so, that's what I'm interested in. And I've developed a system of thinking like that, and the net result is that I've come up with some solutions, which to me, in looking back, are pretty obvious, that things that can be done. For example, how about having a free college education for everyone in the country? That's absolutely possible. It's amazing that we don't have it now. Instead, we have a system where we have to lay out maybe $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $70,000 a year to go to college, and it isn't even tax deductible. But how about having a free college education as something that you actually can create in your town for yourself if you want? I mean, that's what I've developed, a way of doing that. And it's really something that's so obvious. It's something that people should be doing. And yet, we have only one place in America that's going to do it, that's starting to do it. And that place is called Hopeless Indiana. It's a name that I use for the town to disguise its name. But we have one place in America where we're actually going to build, and we're starting to build, a tuition-free college for the residents.
Yes. Now, maybe I should apologize, too, for calling you an attorney, even though, in a sense, we consider the words lawyer and attorney synonymous with each other. I see a lawyer actually as someone who practices the law for the benefit of his or her client, whereas an attorney is representing the business interests exclusively for a particular party. Do you see the distinction between those two words the same way?
No, I don't. An attorney and a lawyer are truly, from my standpoint, interchangeable, and the word lawyer is not as high level, not as highbrow. Attorney is a little bit more highbrow, if you want to be. That's really the only thing that I distinguish between the two. Attorney is more formal, lawyer is less formal, but I don't view it as having any difference in terms of what the individual does. We don't have a distinction like in England between the barrister and the solicitor.
Okay.
In England, the solicitor is a person who will prepare the papers when somebody goes to court. They'll prepare the litigation papers. But the barrister is somebody who will then argue those points to the judge.
Uh-huh.
And there's a difference, but not in America.
Well, then I take back my apology. Thank you for pointing that out. My audience understands my dry sense of humor. So, now, in the sense of what you do and what you are proposing here, you bring up Hopeless Indiana, and I know of a specific situation where the first attorney general on the local level is going to be implemented, and that's for the benefit of the public. That's the you are going to be the knight in shining armor, so to speak, who is going to come to the rescue of the community and have the community's best interests at heart. Despite the fact that we elect officials who are supposed to be doing that, we've come to learn the hard way it's the other way around, isn't it?
Well, that's true, it is, and we especially at the national level, they've given away our country. We've absolutely lost our country. They've stolen it from us, and there seems to be very little that we could do. And it's surprising that if we could go back to several years ago, when I first proposed this concept of the town attorney general. That was back in the year 2003. My idea then was I recognized that government, starting with Richard M. Nixon, and I knew Nixon because I worked in his law firm, so I can really remember Richard M. Nixon, and he became, and he was president. And starting with Nixon, the government started to have less and less enforcement of law that protected the people. It was a gradual reduction over the years of enforcement, which means that the antitrust laws, which interest me, the laws that allow people to go into business and to compete, those laws were not being enforced, and I saw it, and I understood what was going on because I was an antitrust lawyer. And I developed this thought in the year 2003 that why don't we have enforcement take place at the lowest level of government by creating an office for an attorney. And I said, let's call that attorney a town attorney general. And let's subdivide and decentralize the awesome power of the attorney general of a state and bring it right down to the lowest level and have that individual enforce those laws that the federal government is no longer enforcing, such as the securities laws. Is anyone now, looking back 6 years later, does anyone now see any securities laws that we could have enforced that might have stopped what was going on, what's now going on in the country?
Oh, absolutely.
See what we could have had? We could have had enforcement. If there are approximately 40,000 towns, villages, and counties in the United States, we could have had 40,000 people like me enforcing these laws and preventing what we have seen now that's going on to rob us of our future.
Yeah, from my perspective, from my research, it seems that many of the attorneys, lawyers, whatever you want to call them, even judges, are part of this whole thing. That they turned a blind eye to what's happening, that the people that are running the SEC have turned a blind eye to the very regulations that are supposed to ensure that that the capital investments that people make in the stock markets, or whatever type of market we're talking about, because there have been some new creatures created, really, which have become the vehicles for the very embezzlement that you're talking about, the derivatives and hedge funds, which are basically pyramid schemes or Ponzi schemes.
Here's an example of what you're saying. This summer, when a lot of activity was taking place, we had the disclosures starting this summer of all the terrible things that are happening in the securities markets. And at that time during the summer, I was on defense duty representing a stockbroker who was accused of stealing or taking a bribe to steer his customers into buying certain stocks. And he was accused of taking $87,500. Now, this is at a time when the country and the SEC they're witnessing the theft of trillions of dollars. Can you believe that I'm on trial now during the summer for $87,500, and every single one of the attorneys at the SEC responsible for enforcement of the securities laws come into my courtroom and watch my trial while these large companies are stealing trillions of dollars? They're not doing anything to stop the trillions of dollars of theft, but they're all out there in force. All seven of the lawyers are out there in force watching an $87,000 trial.
Yeah, it's very much like Martha Stewart's case or
Leona Helms' show. I mean, they do... And, you know, this is, years ago I brought suit against the Department of Consumer Affairs in New York City. And I had the commissioner under oath in her office taking a deposition. Mm-hmm. And I asked this Department of Consumer Affairs chairman, why is it that every time you issue a press release explaining all the great things that your office is doing, it's always against some small guy, like a butcher that puts his hand or his thumb on the scale and steals a dollar or two, or some bully bill collector that is calling up people from his little telephone in his office saying, if you don't pay, I'm gonna get you. I mean, why don't you go after the biggest companies that are stealing hundreds of millions, I said then. And she said, you don't really want to know. I said, yes, I do. I said, please tell me. She said, you don't want to hear this. I said, please, you're under oath, tell me. She said, okay, I'll tell you. They don't give us enough money to go after the big guys. All we get is enough money to go after the small guys, and I do what I can do. That's all I do. If I had the money, I would go after the big guys. How do you like that?
Very interesting deduction.
Yeah. And it's the same with the SEC, by the way. They do not have the money to go after the big guys. They just don't have the funding. But they go after the small guys. It's a deliberate underfinancing. The courts are underfinanced, by the way. And you know why they underfinance the court system?
To protect the big guys.
Yeah, of course. So they don't want anyone taking the money from the big guy. So by having an inadequate number of judges, what they do is they force the judges to get rid of cases. We deliberately do not have enough judges. And imagine if we devoted 5% of our economy to having a judicial system that made the other 95% really work quite well. Imagine if we had 5 times as many judges, and that people who had complaints about overcharging by banks with late fees that are usurious, securities that aren't secure, that are fraudulent. Imagine if we could bring a lawsuit and get justice by having enough judges who had an interest in doing the right thing. But we don't have enough judges. We have people that are put there politically. We have a system. Well, let's go into the SEC, for example.
Okay.
Let's say that somebody in the SEC is investigating a major corporation. The people in the major corporation, they know, are going to be hiring people from the SEC in 6 months. So the individuals that go there that investigate the major company are really introducing themselves as possible employees. There's no incentive to do any harm to the major corporation because they're the ones who are hiring. The small people aren't going to hire them. So they go after the small person, they get headlines, big stories that we got an $87,500 crook.
Yeah. In light of that, there is also sort of a dichotomy of what you described going on in certain areas, and I can say without hesitation, in Cook County courts, and for those people that aren't familiar where Cook County is, that's the Chicago area, Chicago, Illinois, there is quite a big money-making scheme going on, primarily with Child Protective Services. Now, we have these recent scandals with a few politicians in your area, your neck of the woods. Elliot Spitzer stepped down from his governorship, and then they went after Rod Blagojevich, the governor of Illinois, under the pretense, we'll say, or the accusation that he was trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat for anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million. And that in order, there's more to that than just selling of the seat. He was supposedly trying to get a position in Washington as maybe the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which is a job that I think Donna Shalala got when she was provost of one of the Wisconsin universities during the Wantagate scandal. And then Tommy Thompson ended up getting the job afterward. We have these payoffs that are seeming to occur for corruption that goes on. Now, in the case of Wisconsin, there was an $18 billion certificate or treasury certificates worth $18 billion supposedly in Leo Wanta's suitcase. Now, if that was true, and the political appointments that occurred were not prosecuted. They weren't brought up until Christopher Story and myself started writing about that case. And we have a similar thing that's been going on for the same period of time, for many, many years, actually, in Cook County, where they are profiting from the courts. They say, this is a contradiction to your statement. I'm not saying you don't know what you're talking about. I happen to know specifically that they're financing much of the illegal real estate money laundering through this. They send this money down to Maricopa County, Arizona, in trust pools, which you are familiar with because of your current litigation. You may want to talk about that for a moment. But in another sense, this money is being stolen even through the court systems. Now, this money is not just taken and it's not kept by the courts to operate the courts. They're putting these in private pools in hedge funds and derivatives into what are called fidelity accounts. And they're primarily deposited into offshore accounts. The bailout was initiated because of the frozen foreign accounts as a result of the Basel II agreement, which really demands that we go on a gold standard as well. So we have this illegal money laundering that's actually being perpetrated by organized crime. And judges and lawyers or attorneys, whatever you want to call them, and expert witnesses in the court system, such as the psychologists and the child advocates that are working on behalf of supposedly abused kids, have become participants in these things. And these, are, of course, all illegal, these pure trusts. This is nothing but racketeering. So in the sense of an upstanding judge, yes, that judge is not seeing the funding to prosecute these major cases. And on the other hand, there are hundreds of judges, like in Chicago, who are participating in these schemes on the backside, which is really enabling those who are laundering this money. Could be drug money. Could be money from illegal weapon sales that are refunneled into that because, as you said, our country has been stolen. It's being systematically stolen by stealing the very land on which we are standing. You want to comment on any of that, Carl?
Yes, I do not know of corruption in the sense that a judge takes money. I know that there are some judges and they've been thrown in jail when they get caught sometimes, and other times they probably get off. But I don't see the corruption in that sense. I see a system by which the judges don't enforce the law, and they allow the crooks to get off because they don't allow people like me to go in there and bring lawsuits to get justice. We wind up not being able to bring suits and stop the practices that we're complaining about. And the courts allow these people to get away with what they're doing on technicalities. Now, I don't honestly believe, in fact, that the judges, for the most part, and I'm saying like 99%, are having their hand out anywhere in order to reach these decisions that they reach. I just see that a system that's overcrowded is one that requires a judge to get rid of cases. But by having too many cases per judge, for example, how many trials do you think that a judge has every week in the federal court system?
Oh, I couldn't say. It may be in the hundreds, or it may be a handful.
In the court system, I believe that a typical judge probably has maybe 7 or 8 trials a year, civil trials.
Yeah, I'm saying
they
hundreds may come their way. Yeah,
they really don't have that many. The cases either get thrown out of court, or they get settled because people know that they're going to get thrown out of court more than likely at some level. So people wind up either getting thrown out or getting settled, and once in a while you have a trial, but you don't have that many trials, so that we don't have people really getting the right to a jury trial. They lose that right by a process called summary judgment. There the judge will take a look at the papers that the big company defendant puts into court, a motion for summary judgment, which says to the court or the judge, please, Your Honor, we don't see that there are any issues of fact that should be resolved before a jury. So please, Your Honor, decide this on the motion papers and throw these rascals out of court, because they're really just, they have no case. And too often the judges grant those motions. And part of the thing is that if a judge doesn't have time to try every single case that's before him or her, there's just not enough time in life to try all these cases, and yet they have to dispose of them. So I see that the lack of a sufficient number of judges and judicial facilities forces good cases to be thrown out of court. And there's a tendency for the more important cases like antitrust, which are truly terrible cases to try. They're so long and involved that what judge really wants to try an antitrust case? So as a result, the judges find it easier just to throw out the case on a technicality. But even worse than that, if the judge doesn't throw it out, the judge is afraid that the higher court will, and then the judge will have wasted his or her time in giving a trial. So I've had a judge tell me, look, I'm going to dismiss this case, and if you can convince the higher court to bring it back and send it back to me, I'd be perfectly pleased to try the case. But meanwhile, I'm not going to waste my time giving you a trial now only to see the higher court reverse it if it goes up there.
Yeah,
well, that's what I see from my standpoint. But I recognize that there is so much corruption out here. There's so much huge amounts of money that anyone is vulnerable, regardless of what profession they're in. You can have a radio owner that will pervert the news and give the wrong news to the public because they make money doing that. You'll have newspapers doing the same. You'll have postmen maybe not delivering the mail if somebody pays them enough money. I mean, every one of us is subject to huge amounts of money. If somebody offered you $1 or $10 million to do something wrong, people will think, maybe I can get away with it. So it's a system here. We have too much money that can be thrown at people to corrupt them. And look at the people that spent their lives selling worthless paper and getting $255,000 a year annual or Christmas bonuses to do that. Selling worthless paper to people, that was a big profession. Everyone everyone taking a master's degree was saying, gee, I'd like to go to Wall Street and join that group. They were out for the money, not out to help people.
Yeah, going back just for a brief moment to what you were describing in the justice system, it's sort of an oxymoron it really maybe should be renamed the Department of Injustice, because there's a lot more of that occurring if one feels that they're bringing a case before the court that warrants an examination, that someone has actually been wronged. And I'm not talking about frivolous lawsuits. That seems to be a popular term, in fact, when when the corporation does get that summary judgment, often they say, well, this is just a frivolous lawsuit, and it's intended to demean the character of the person bringing about the action, much like when we talk about these things, we're called conspiracy theorists by those that want to paint a broad brush over the particular issue that we're bringing to light, as if somehow that statement just totally undoes the information. It discredits the information. It discredits the messenger. And I think we must start taking things into our own hands, because we're just playing the rules of a system that's deemed for failure.
We have an opportunity to do that, and I have worked on a system that I think can allow a town or village to be able to free itself up from a lot of what's going on and really operate much more efficiently and prosperously for its residents. And I am working on that basically because I think that this is the way to bring reform politically to the country, by starting at the grassroots level, starting at the lowest level of government, and taking just one town, which we'll call Hopeless Indiana, and showing how one town can actually raise itself by its own bootstraps, things that they can do in a town to really make themselves prosperous and to try to avoid a lot of these evils that are plaguing us in the overall economy. I think we can build a town. Any town can change itself, and one of these changes, a great one, I think, is to have a free college education available to every person in the town, regardless of age. I mean, what a phenomenal thing to be able to raise the level of education of everyone or the whole town on the average to something way above the average level of education in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth money to have people know more and be able to take greater advantage and be able to compete more effectively in the nation and in the world. It's just a tremendous asset for the town, and we can do that for nothing. We can actually put a college in there, an equivalency college, and allow people to get an education that doesn't cost anything to them. And the total cost really isn't that much, because there obviously are expenses. But I have a way by which these expenses can be covered by someone else. It makes sense to, you don't even have to charge the people going to school. You can, there's a way of covering those costs. So the first step is to have a college that, an equivalency college that can be set up, and it's a stripped-down version of a normal college where you take out all the high-cost, non-educational features. You've got to really ruthlessly cut out these expenses.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need people mowing the lawn on a campus, because you're not going to have a campus lawn to mow. You don't need a dispensary. You don't need food service. You don't need dormitories. You don't need libraries. You don't need trucks and maintenance people and vehicles driving around. You really have to simplify a college and cut it down and just create the bare essentials of education. And they are classrooms in an office space environment, seats, tablet type, where students can take notes, a blackboard or maybe a portable easel of some sort where an instructor can write on white paper or on a blackboard. You need an instructor, and you need a curriculum. You don't really need much more than that other than students. And that is about $2,000 a year per student, assuming a class size of about 30, no more than 30 people in a class. The cost is about $2,000 a year. And imagine if you have portable office space in a town towns are hurting. They have a lot of unrented space. You could actually pick up unused space and move a college if the space is rented. You could move it easily overnight to other space, so you don't even have to pay high rent. You can get your rent for peanuts. So your cost per student is about $2,000 a year, and that's about a package of cigarettes a day. That's what it costs to go to college in my environment, what I'm talking about. But mm-hmm. we have a way of covering that, and this is how it works. There's a market.
What you're describing, one will have to forego the football team and the basketball team and baseball and tennis and swimming and all of those superfluous courses that may have some value in terms of physical fitness or athleticism, but you know the things, these incidental costs that you're describing are part of the bigger picture of the accredited institutions where one gets a degree and basically buys their way or their ticket into the system, into the matrix. Would you agree?
Yes, we're talking like some of the higher costs involved in some of the costs involved in higher education that I think should be eliminated are the costs of tenure and the costs of accreditation and the costs of being eligible for and receiving student loans and all the attendant regulation that goes along with it. Those are very high cost items when it comes to the actual dollar amounts that are being spent to carry the certification or the accreditation and the licensing for the student loans. You have a lot of extra work, a lot of additional costs that really don't add up to anything. You know, you can't regulate the quality of education. It's something that is there. You can put it together and you can see it and you can get it, but you can't regulate it. We haven't been able to, but how would you then have how would you have government involved in education? Because they have to try to regulate it, otherwise why is the government involved in the first place? So mm-hmm. the government gets involved and sets up regulation that really has nothing to do with anything except it causes higher costs and diminishes the educational value. And it's something that you can get rid of. You don't have to have it. You can have a college at a local level where people live at home, they eat at home, they drive to the college or they walk or take a bike, and if you have free parking particularly, you can have a college education for about a package of cigarettes a day. But the funding of it is really interesting. The way the $2,000 should be paid is that older people in the town can donate their insurability so that anyone that's 73 years to 83 years of age who is in good health, is wealthy, and underinsured can allow the school to put an insurance policy on that person's life.
Mm-hmm.
If that's done, the insurance policy is worth $30,000 at the moment that it's issued. It's worth $30,000 immediately when the person signs and says, yes, I accept the policy on my life. There's a market. There's people who will pay the premium for the insurance and give you $30,000 to assign the policy to them. 2 years later, if you wanted to wait, you can get $100,000 for the policy after the two-year period for contestability has expired. That two-year period, by the way, is created by insurance companies so that if somebody commits suicide within a two-year period, the insurance company will deny coverage and say that you took out the policy with the intention of committing suicide and therefore we're not going to pay. But people weren't buying insurance because 3 and 4 years after the policy was taken out, the insurance companies said, you bought this 4 years ago because you were going to commit suicide, so we're going to deny coverage. so that in order that the insurance companies could sell these policies, a statute was passed prohibiting the insurance company from having contestability beyond a two-year period. So at the end of the two-year period, the policy is now worth $100,000. So that, and then if you don't sell the policy but hold on to it, and the person who is 73 to 83 years old dies at some point, the school collects $1 million. So in a small town, if you have 21 policies, you take the first seven and cash them in immediately. That gives you $210,000 for the school. 2 years later, you cash in the other another third of the policies, and that gives you $700,000 in cash. And you have the other third of the policies, and every year or so, a person dies, and you get another million. That's how you can finance the school.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So it's up to the people in the community to convince that person to stay alive for at least 2 years.
No, not really. Because the policy is worth, no, not at all.
It's worth face value upon a natural death.
Yeah, it's only the suicide. I mean, if a person dies a normal death within the two-year period, the contestability doesn't apply.
Yeah, one wonders how many bankers who are supposedly committing suicide these days have those policies, you know?
How many bankers committing suicide today are really catching a boat to their ill-gotten gains in some foreign land?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, this is the proper application of such a financial vehicle, so that's certainly worth anyone looking into. And obviously, anyone interested listening to this should contact Carl just for the purpose of investigating it further for your area. This is not something that Carl is promoting exclusively for one place in the country. This can be done throughout the country. Of course, the powers that be have created their own system, which rewards them in innumerable ways.
You know, Don, I think we should make it clear, mm-hmm. and I'll let you be the salesman for me here. How much am I getting out of this?
I'm not aware of anything other than the satisfaction of seeing our country uprighted again and put on its feet. You know, the country is the people themselves.
That's all. I'm trying to show that reform is possible. And
yeah.
Imagine if I would go into a town and say, look, I can help you become prosperous, and I want to do it, but please give me a check for $50,000 first, and then I'll make you prosperous. I wouldn't get any takers.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go in and do it the way I'm doing it. I have to go in there and absolutely promise that this is what I'm willing to do for you, and I'm not asking any money. And can you believe how few takers there are in the United States? I can't believe it, that here we have an opportunity. Any town has an opportunity to improve itself and to bring really $25,000 or $50,000 of income in per participant that wants to register his tasks on my website, and it's all for free. So you can have people earning $25,000 or $50,000 a year as independent contractors offering their tasks. You have an attorney general concept where you can sue the wrongdoers and make the town better and use the proceeds to give free health care and free broadband to the residents. You can have a free college for the residents, and you can have a payroll system by which the costs are really pooled, and you have a very efficient system for managing payroll for the town's small businesses and even the homeowners that might be hiring domestics, babysitters, or others. It's such a remarkable thing that you can do to bring prosperity into a town. People only have to demand it. Call up their legislators and their mayors and say, why don't you look into this? why don't you do it? And Don, you and I have gone through this, and without saying where hopeless is, and without identifying any people that are involved, the meeting took place. It took about 4 hours to discuss all this, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas are saleable. They really, the town can benefit by it, and the leaders of the town understand that. And it's something that really any town can do if a resident of the town asks the town or makes it known to the town that this stuff is available. My God, go out and do it. And this is where you have the power to improve yourself.
Yes. That it's hard for a lot of people. I'm not saying it's impossible, but you know, admittedly, it's difficult for people to grasp this concept because it's really not as complex as it seems. We have become so ingrained into this matrix, this system, that things are a certain way, and they have become so powerful that there's nothing that we can do about it. And so we have to just go along and accept things the way they are. And if they change, they're going to change because of something that someone outside of ourselves can do for us. And that's always been the promise. Isn't that the promise of the politician while he's campaigning or she is campaigning for whatever office they're running for? And yet, time after time, we see that those are nothing but promises. They're not even taken seriously at the time they're dished out. We are always sold this concept of hope, this air that or this cloud that might appear in the air, make itself become visible and tangible in some sense, never occurs. And yet that is the trick, or that is the modus operandi of the politicians, sort of like dangling a bone in front of us, or a carrot. It's that promise of hope that really disempowers us, because we just put all our power, all our trust in the hands of another, who really has no intention of doing anything for us. Now, there are exceptions to those rules. We know of a particular individual that is the exception. And so what we're saying here is that this is a way for us to empower ourselves. If you want to affect the change, you can affect the change in your life immediately by following what Carl is talking about, by at least informing yourself of how this works and what the possibilities are.
Let me give the website name that describes everything. There's more than just four items. There's a lot of additional items. But the website is called election-issues-us.com. election-issues-us.com. And that website has these different ideas, and they're pretty fully developed. One does not need me, by the way, to do this. It's all there. I'm not really needed except try to describe what people can do. It's all on the website. You can read the website, bring it to the attention of your political leaders in the town, and really go out and do it yourself. But I would be happy, Don and I both would be happy, to assist in any way that we can. But we have no magic here. It's all out there for you to read and do.
Mm-hmm. Carl, can you be careful of how you're holding your phone? Your audio changed all of a sudden.
Sorry. Is this better?
Yeah, that is. You may have been holding it closer to your mouth or something. Okay. That's very... very good point to make. I'm just trying to give an overview from my perspective of what I see here. You know, the overall picture is someone who's looking to this is related to your MyClad site. In our closing minutes here, I'd like to cover this in a general sense. You've come out with this website, myclads.com, which is it's a vehicle where one can market their abilities, their talents, whether it's a service or a product that they can bring forth to the community. And we're not talking about jobs here per se. We're talking about tasks that one can perform. And you have actually equated what that would bring to a town of, say, 10,000 people. It doesn't have to be a large city. Share with us some of your thoughts on that, if you would.
Yes. If a town is experiencing financial adversity, it's because people that want to do work have many hours available for which no work is being performed. So in a town of, say, 10,000 people, I calculate that there's approximately $250 million worth of unused hours available per year if we can find a way to put them to work. So if we have everyone in town that wants to do work for money, list on my website the tasks that they would like to perform, and just list them as keywords: mow lawns, tutor quantum mechanics high school level, draw caricatures for newspaper or magazine. I mean, there's just a million things that people could do, but when I'm looking for someone to do what I want to have done, I don't know where to find that person. So a website that has everyone listing what they do or would like to do, and you can list 500 or 1,000 different things, all for free. You can put a link to your own website and create a website so that if you mow lawns, you would then link to your own website that would show pictures of you and the equipment and your phone number and your fax number and their price list and your customers' recommendations and all that. So it's a new system of marketing the hours that we have available to perform a useful task. Instead of looking for jobs where people no longer want to hire us, we can put our time to work by performing and offering tasks. And if we do that, we can then market those tasks as a town to the adjoining radius of about 25 miles around the town. And it's a very low-cost advertising to do that because you're using local newspapers, local cable, television, and radio, and it's very inexpensive. But it's a 2,000-square-mile radius, not the radius, but the area surrounding your town is 2,000 square miles. That's a lot of people that you can be marketing your services to and beyond. But effectively, the advertising can reach 2,000 square miles at almost no cost per resident and bring in that kind of money. Now, the way that what I'm interested in is having the people in that 2,000 square miles say, why should we be giving our money to that town when we, too, can be offering our own ads? And if it works, my website will spread and we will have a national market for tasks that will be really the successor to the jobs that people no longer want to give to Americans.
Yes, and you also presented this in a way that one will ask, how do you arrive at this figure of a quarter of a billion dollars?
$30 an hour. I calculated $30 an hour of the value of the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's very empowering to someone who may be contemplating going to work in a restaurant in the hope of making some tips and maybe making $2.15 an hour on their time card.
Have you heard of IKEA furniture? I don't know if you have them
where you are. Yeah. I've actually been in various parts of the country.
They require you to assemble a lot of what they sell. And there's a desk, for example, that I bought many years ago. And the assembly really is outrageously difficult, except if somebody knows how to do it and has the tools, has the experience, what would take me 5 or 6 hours to do and a lot of unpleasantness, they could do in an hour. But I would certainly, mm-hmm. if I had to do it over again, pay a person $75 or more to do that task for me. So a person could earn, say, $75 for an hour's work. Of course, there's travel time and other things, but then, let's face it, you're not going to get 40 hours at 75, but if you did earn $100 a day on the average, that's $25,000 a year tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
There's no tax withheld. That's quite an improvement for somebody that doesn't have a job.
Yes. And now there are also those people out there that know how to build furniture from scratch too, which is an option.
I mean, just there's every conceivable task in the world should be on that website, and allow people like anyone that could put tasks on the website would also have tasks that they would like to have performed by others. So it's a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not barter, it's money.
Yeah. Well, that's like the want ads in the newspaper. They work both ways. And, again, you're calling that site MyClads, MyClads.com.
And it means MyClassifiedAdvertisements.com. That's the mm-hmm. meaning of that phrase or that word.
Mm-hmm. And there is no charge for doing this on your website, if I'm correct.
That's correct. And the ads last forever. I'm going to have to figure, the way I figure it, that every communication will involve will have a link that will allow the one who runs the ad to decide whether they still want to be offering that ad, and they can then take off the ad themselves when they get an interest where they no longer themselves want to perform that task. So I see Craigslist requires that you have your ad limited to like South Utica, New York, and that mm-hmm. your ad is only good for 7 days or so. But if a person is putting on 500 or 1,000 ads, you're not going to be able to do that every week. You need to have the ads there permanently or at least for a year. But I just say let's leave them on permanently and allow attrition to take them off by mm-hmm. a person really saying, well, I'm no longer interested. Let me remove that ad so I don't get any other people bothering me on that ad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Carl, I hate to cut this short, but we are out of time. We've used up our hour. I want to thank you, not just for being on the show, but for doing the work you're doing. It's revolutionary in a sense, and in a very peaceful way. So,
yeah, and it's so obvious that this is where we need to be going. It's so obvious. It's just these are natural things that I've identified that we can be doing to help ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I want to wish you and your family a very happy New Year.
Very good. And this is New Year's Eve throughout the United States right now, I guess, or almost. What is it? No, not quite.
Well, West Coast has another 54 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So, and Hawaii, an extra 3 hours on top of that.
Oh, boy.
So I want to thank you, and I know you're going to be on with us again next year, which is just around the corner in January.
I look forward to it.
Yes, I am too as well. And so I want to thank you and wish you the best.
Thanks a lot. Good night now.
Okay. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. If you enjoyed tonight's show, be sure to tell your friends download a copy. If they are not a subscriber to BBSRadio.com, encourage them to become one. You can download all. Seth, if you can hear that, maybe you can kill that line. Oh, thank you. Okay. maybe you can encourage them to subscribe. You can download all the archives for a 1-year subscription on on the network, which is a great deal. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, for Seth Hendrick on the sound tonight, and most of all to the listening audience, those of you who are going to be partying tonight and possibly missing the show. We will be broadcasting. Our special guest will be Michael Anthony to help celebrate the new year. New Year's Day, Ken Adachi, followed by Jim Murray on Friday at the end of this week. So please tune in. We're going to have some great shows. Lots going on. In the meantime, I want to thank everyone in the listening audience for tuning in. You have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.